Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin. And every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve speaks with Dragos Tudorache, a member of the European Parliament and co-architect of the EU's AI Act. Dragos explains the thought process that went into developing the new legislation. He also shares with Steve what organizations can expect and how they can prepare for its implementation.
Dragos, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. It's great to have you.
Many thanks for the invite.
Now, you're one of the architects of the EU's AI Act, and you're looking at writing AI regulation in an innovative, what you've referred to as hybrid way. In fact, you've said that you want it to be a model for how we write the rules of AI on the world stage. Tell me a bit about that. What do you actually mean by that?
Well, it's a hybrid because we've been playing at the beginning, first of all, with the question that everyone is asking, do we have to? Is it necessary to come with hard rules on AI? Ultimately, still a tool, even if it's a sophisticated one, but still a tool. And how do you regulate technology? How do you regulate tools in general? And isn't it enough to just set some principles, voluntary commitments as being used in other jurisdictions, and then work with the industry, work with the players in the market to achieve what you want to get at the end? And our analysis, and this has already been done some years ago, 2018, 2019, was that voluntary was not enough, and that looking at the back then potential risks, in the meantime, many of those potential risks have become actual risks. To mitigate them, to address them, to induce trust and confidence in society in how this technology is interacting with the lives of people and with the economy and also with democracy and geopolitics, you need some standards, you need some rules of the game. And those rules of the game have to be written into law. This was the philosophy on the EU side. And it is hybrid because at first it was imagined by the Commission as a product safety regulation that just regulates the market and puts some safeguards for that. But in the meantime, and also very much in the conversations and the debates and the internal processes in the Parliament, it has grown to be much more than that, because we looked at also risks, the broader risks to society, to democracy, what it does to our electoral processes and democracy. And therefore, it has moved from being just a product based to being this very comprehensive, horizontal set of rules, set of norms for how AI is being used in our society and economies. And again, because it is the first one, it is the first comprehensive attempt to set these rules, it does play a very important role in the broader global conversation on AI.
You've mentioned that it is now very much more broad-reaching than you had originally intended. What are the implications of that for member states and also for those that are not within the EU?
Well, I think the big challenge of this text is to, and that's also very much a concern for our, let's say, internal EU market, is how you balance out the interest to protect those rights that you want to protect, those values that you want to protect in society and the individual's rights that you want to protect, and at the same time, create space for innovation. So allow your economies to benefit from AI. Allow an industry to grow and develop AI tools, because this is the future, right? So for our EU market, getting this balance right, giving that confidence to the consumers, to the citizens, that this is something that is not harming their interests, while at the same time giving the industry and the economic actors the space they need to innovate without unnecessary hindrance and burden of compliance, is the most important balancing act we need to do right now in the regulation. For the outside world, it represents a standard. It represents a standard, first of all, in the absence of other standards, but right. It also represents a model of how to tackle technology in a space at a global level where you have some other models. You have a Chinese model, which puts the state at the very top and the interests of the state controlling society, because this is how it understands its role vis-a-vis its citizens. That's the Chinese way of looking at technology, and then deploying technology in society. It is used to control society, not to give it rights and find that balance. And then one would say, not necessarily divergent, but a different take on the US side, where it was the economy and the big players that have been driving a lot of the standards without an intervention from the state. And many say that these three models are in competition. At least as far as the US and the EU model, I don't see a competition. At least I would like to see that we are striving to have convergence rather than competition, because ultimately, I think we have both grown to, maybe admire is a strong of a word, but to understand the benefits of the other's focus. I think on our side, on the EU side, we realize then we have to invest in this realization even more, that you cannot do it top down. You have to work with the industry. You have to work with your economic actors if you want to, number one, understand exactly what happens with AI, if you want to understand exactly what the consequences are, if you want to understand how the evolution is going to go. And also in terms of enforcing, you have to build in a mechanism of co-generation, of adapting constantly the rules to stay in sync with how the technology evolves. So I think the European way of doing regulation, of addressing this, has to also get educated from the way the US has been developing ecosystems for technology over the last decades and how they have addressed this up to now. While at the same time, I think on the US side, at least from the conversations that I've had with many policymakers in the US, I think they also start looking at what society expects. Mm-hmm. And the safeguards that they understand they need to put in place for society to trust, to have confidence in the way the big players in this market operate, in the way these tools are interacting with their interests. And I think the idea of introducing safeguards and of balancing those safeguards with the interest to stay on top of innovation and on top of growing this industry is something that also on the US side they need to address. So, in fact, I'd like to say that the two models are growing towards each other. And at some point, in fact, we will achieve a level of functional equivalence that would be beneficial, first and foremost, for companies who will not have to play with two different standards when addressing the US or the EU market, and therefore, afterwards, rolling further the rest of the global market. Because if we will be having an equivalent standard in the US and the EU, that will, I would say, almost by default become a global standard.
Right.
And will also benefit citizens and the effort to have a streamlined governance at a global stage when it comes to how we regulate this technology.
Now, one of the things that traditionally has been a challenge when it comes to regulating technology is that technology evolves so very quickly and the process of legislation has traditionally been rather slow. So how confident are you with the Act that what you've currently got is going to be effective once implemented across member states, and that the technology won't have advanced beyond what it is that you've currently regulated for? Because I think that's a question that certainly a number of people put to me whenever I talk about regulation. It's how do you put something in place that is able to be sufficiently reflective of the speed at which a technology is evolving? So what have you done with regard to that?
Well, first to say it's a very fair point, and I think when addressing that, we have to be very, very humble in understanding how important that is. Because if we don't get this right, if we're going to come up with rules that will not make sense, and I refer to what I was saying earlier also about staying in sync with reality.
Yes.
If you're not having that constant reality check as to where, in fact, the technology has gone and how you make sure that what you have in terms of rules, obligations, rights are synchronized with that evolution, then again, the whole purpose is dead. How and what do you do to achieve that? First of all, of course, it's in the way you write those obligations and making them as technology neutral as possible. In other words, when you formulate an obligations of transparency, for example, you do it in a way that would apply to the technology today and it will apply the same way to the technology of tomorrow, even if it has grown or changed or morphed 10 times until, I don't know, you will knock at their door again. but whether or not you have to show me the data that you use to train the algorithm, for example, that obligation sounds the same, right?
Right.
And that is valid for many other. We are working with legislation from 100 years ago, not that the economic or social relations haven't changed or haven't evolved, but the core of the obligation or the rights that you have in a piece of legislation remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one way. So certain parts of the text, which could be made technology neutral, we've done so, and we've made sure that the formulation of the obligations is in a way that will stand the test of time. But inevitably, when you deal with technology, there are also technical parts of the text, where the criteria, for example, that differentiate between certain category of models or applications of AI versus others, or technical descriptions of some of the use cases of AI that you want to put in the category of high risk or the prohibited practices. So all of those things are technical in nature, and therefore they are not technology neutral. So for those ones, what we have done and what we are doing is to introduce mandates in the text that allows for the future governance that we will set in place with this act to constantly adapt the text to stay in line with the evolution of technology. For example, the list of use cases that will be high risk under this regulation, we understand that that cannot be fixed in time because either there'll be new use cases appearing that will justify that they will be put in the list, or maybe practice will show you that one of the use cases that now you thought would be inducing certain risks, in reality, it doesn't.
Right.
Or that it has evolved in a way that you need to tweak the way you've described it, or the criteria that you use to differentiate between what is high risk and what is not. So for those aspects, we are giving a mandate so that the future governance working, and that's a very important point. We have introduced ourselves in Parliament a provision that links to the governance structure an advisory body. An advisory body where we want to see a structural dialogue with the stakeholders, industry, civil society, academia, consumer groups. So all those that understand both the evolution of technology, but also its consequences upon deployment, so that they constantly feed their reality, their version of what and where the technology is at a given moment in time, feed it to those that are meant to do those adaptations, so that whenever you trigger an adaptation of the text, you do it knowing very well what the reality is in the market at that very moment in time. And I think that with the combination of these two, securing obligations that are technology neutral with mandates to adapt the text, and by the way, these adaptations will be done quite quickly. There's a special process in the EU legislative machinery, which is called comitology, where only based on experts' advice, you can initiate changes of certain parts as long as you have the mandate in the original text, parts of the text, so that you do it rather quick based on expert input and therefore keep the legislation alive and relevant.
Fantastic. Let's move on now to talk about privacy and civil liberties. I mean, one of the big concerns or a big discussion point when it comes to potentially problematic use of AI is actually about how governments and law enforcements might use it in a way that encroaches on civil liberties and indeed on privacy. How do we ensure that citizens' rights are protected in that instance?
Well, first and foremost, if one takes a look at what we have identified in this text as high risk, a good part of them actually have to do exactly with the issue of privacy and rights, and often also with the intersection between the state's interest, sometimes legitimate interest to protect our security, but also the intersection between those interests and the interests of individuals to have their lives being led as they see fit without unnecessary and undue interference. So again, already in the way we've designed some of the use cases that are high risk, and high risk means what? It means that they will come with a burden for those developing or deploying, a burden of transparency, of accountability, of explainability, to so that I as a citizen, you as a citizen, we know that this tool that interacts with us and with our interests, whether it's a, I don't know, it's an algorithm that decides whether I get to have a pension or I don't, or I get to have a social benefit or I don't get to have a social benefit. So that all of these AI-powered tools that the states will be using more and more in the future are tools that I can trust. I understand how they are trained. I understand the instructions that were given to them. I am being reassured that through transparency, that there was no bias in those data sets, there was no bias in the instructions that were given to the algorithm, so that I can trust it. But it's not only that. There has to be more in terms of safeguards from my point of view, from our point of view as Parliament, and that's why we've introduced redress, for example, something that did not exist in the initial proposal of the Commission. But we've introduced an individual redress. Every citizen will have the possibility to basically sue companies or the state and actually seek redress for any harm that they would consider an AI has given to them. Then for those applications where we will be introducing, and that's a very important question, where we'll be introducing exceptions for law enforcement in the access to certain tools, and probably you know one of the big discussions was about biometrics in public spaces, real-time use. Again, safeguards will have to be very strong. We in Parliament even put a total ban on that. Remains to be seen in the negotiations to come exactly where the cursor will end. But in any case, for us, it is essential that every time a law enforcement uses AI, yes, to protect our safety, but with the potential for abuse or breach of rights, that is done with safeguards that can ensure that there is a control as to how that use is being made, and also with important redress so that we can actually seek our rights and seek compensation when something goes wrong.
Let's talk about the oversight, though, of AI, because it's all very well us talking here about transparency and trust. But what's going to be the role of human oversight in all of this? So do we have to assign teams, committees to review outputs from AI, for example? Or you know, can you give us some examples of how we might be able to provide effective human oversight over some of the things you've just been talking about?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, the concept of human oversight or human in the loop, as we call it, for all of these applications that would be high risk. So basically to make sure that you don't only trust the recommendation or the output that comes from a machine, even if you have taken upstream some obligations and you have done also your duty of care in terms of how you have trained the algorithm, how you have instructed the algorithm to make sure that you do away as much as possible with bias or discrimination or any of the harms that are potential in the deployment of these tools. Also, what we're saying with this legislation is that there always has to be a human responsibility at the very end of the process. You cannot simply take on recommendations that come from an algorithm and use them to determine someone's interests and someone's rights. So that element of human oversight is key. And then there's the issue of enforcement, which is also very important, which is that for, again, and we're not putting a blanket obligation and a blanket enforcement on all AI, but it's for those high-risk applications that are being identified and detected as such, where the enforcers, both at national level and at EU level, will have the possibility to constantly stay on top of how the deployment is going. And then in an interaction with the developers and the deployers, they can correct mistakes that appear in the applications. They can go all the way to basically taking applications off the market if the corrections are not satisfactory. And there's also a very, I would say, dissuasive regime of sanctions and fines that can be applied in case corrections in that interaction do not happen.
I think one of the other things that people often question me about is just whether or not we are actually able to be in control of the speed at which AI is evolving. And earlier in the year, a number of AI and tech leaders, as you know, signed a letter calling for a pause on further development of AI systems for a period of months. And the letter said in particular that developers are locked in an out-of-control race to develop and deploy even more powerful digital minds that no one, not even their creators, can understand, predict, or reliably control. What are your thoughts on such efforts to slow down the development of AI? Is it something that we should be doing until we get a better feel for exactly how powerful this range of technology and systems could be?
Well, I would agree with them and their concerns fully. I would even co-sign their letters and appeals if we were to do nothing. So if we were to remain idle as policymakers and simply say, like some political leaders did say, in the past that, well, AI is a nascent technology. It does wonderful things, which it does, by the way. And therefore, we don't have to worry. We don't have to do things at all right now as policymakers. This was the case for many jurisdictions only 6-9 months ago. In the meantime, ChatGPT happened. In the meantime, large language models, foundation models have sprung to life. And really, finally, I would say, opened the eyes of everyone around the world as to not only the, again, the potential, the benefits of AI, but also risks. Some of them, fundamental risks. Some of them, as many have underlined, existential risks. So again, if we were to then do nothing, then I would be very worried. And in fact, I and the team of shadow rapporteurs have even replied ourselves with an open letter to those letters in spring. And that's exactly what we said, that yes, we agree with you that risk, these risks are real. They warrant a very serious debate in our societies, but that the response to it is that we have to take our responsibility as policymakers in all of the jurisdictions around the world and start committing for some clear safeguards, some clear guardrails to orient, again, not to stop, not to pause, because I don't believe in that pause either. I mean, again, this is helping the growth of our economies, it's helping the growth of our societies. It's, these are good tools, these are good technologies, but we just have to make sure that we signpost their evolution in the right way so they can actually bring their benefits while minimizing the risks. That's ultimately what we're trying to do. So the fact that now you have an AI Act in Europe, the fact that now there is an executive order in the US, the fact that you've had processes since spring, starting with G7 in June, the Hiroshima process that was launched in June. We've had the safety summit in London just a week or so ago. So again, now the world is moving. There is, I think, a growing consensus, even I would say, that there is a need to have a serious global conversation on AI governance. And for me, this is what we need to do. And if we do these things, and if we all also strive as much as we can to achieve what I was mentioning earlier in terms of functional equivalence or interoperability between the different governances that we will be setting up in different jurisdictions around the world, then we would be serving, in a way, our purpose, and then you don't need to consider pauses in the evolution of technology because you have already put in the right safeguards in place to make sure that that evolution does not need to be paused because it's already nicely oriented in the direction that you want.
We've got now the EU's AI Act, which is being discussed or going to be discussed much more widely across member states. What are the next steps? Explain the future for listeners here in terms of what can we expect to see next in terms of the AI Act being rolled out?
Well, we are now in the final stage of the negotiations. And if all things go well, by the end of this year, those negotiations will end, which means the text will be adopted. It doesn't mean that it will come into force immediately, because we realize that there is a need for a gap period for companies to ensure compliance, to roll up their sleeves and get what they need to get in order to be compliant with the text. But also the regulators themselves at national level, at European level, will need time to gear up, find expertise, prepare for the implementation. It's a complex machinery, it's a complex text, and therefore it needs to be well prepared. So there'll be somewhere between a year, year and a half from the moment of adoption, again, sometime at the end of this year or early next year, to the moment when the rules will actually come into force. There is discussion as to whether we can think of some sort of intermediary mechanism where we incentivize early adopters to start already complying before it becomes mandatory, in a way. Mm-hmm. And that is something that the Commission is envisaging, fashioned a bit along the lines of what was done with the DSA. Mm-hmm. Again, with some carrots along the way, with some incentives for the early adopters to find it interesting for them to comply earlier. But in any case, again, by 2025, that is when most likely the legislation will become letter of law, will come into effect. And in the meantime, from now until then, the other thing we need to do, other than, of course, preparing for that moment when the regulation kicks in, is to continue to invest in this global convergence. I cannot stress enough how important it is. And that also means preparing work together on technical standards. Because by the time from now adoption to the moment when it comes into effect, the standard setting bodies at European level will have to work to prepare technical standards to translate in engineering language, basically, what the lawyers are saying in the legislative act. That's a very important work. And that also ideally has to be done in alignment with efforts to write standards on the US side, but also more globally. Because if we're sure, it's something that I always say, if we have this political alignment in terms of the big objectives, the big direction of travel, and we also have alignment at the technical standard level, then we can also absorb easier the potential differences that we'll have in how we legislate, which will exist. Inevitably, there will be differences in the way we legislate, either in terms of content or pace of legislation. But with aligned standards and with a common vision, then the predictability for our companies, the predictability also for consumers, is something that would come much easier.
Dragos, it's been a pleasure listening to you explain the Act and also, I think, giving us that insight into what the future looks like and stressing some really important points around transparency and trust, which are absolutely fundamental to the adoption of AI. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dragos Tudorache for today's conversation. ISF member listeners, be sure to log in to ISF Live to access our most recent research on artificial intelligence and machine learning, securing operational machine learning systems. And to our listeners who haven't yet become an ISF member, get in touch with your regional representative at securityforum.org/join. We'll also link to several recent ISF podcast episodes in the show notes that center around AI and machine learning, and next week we're bringing you an episode focused on AI and the board, so stay tuned. In the meantime, if you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod, music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.